You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
Hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on this episode, we are bringing you an author chat with Lisa Lee, who sits down with us to talk about her debut novel, American Han, a Korean-American family drama about the Kims, a family in crisis as they deal with the repercussions of decades of built-up resentment and grudges stemming from the family's relentless pursuit of the American dream and the model minority myth. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server, where you can chat with Rira, myself, and fellow book club members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly Patron's Choice book club pick, the latest of which is the book we're reading now, The Elsewhere Express, our April book club pick. Thanks again to everyone who is supporting us on Patreon. And as always, we hope to see more of you there.
Yeah, so we talked to Lisa about the patriarchy and misogyny in Korean culture, about Korean mother-daughter relationships, as well as sibling dynamics, and also some of the emotions that immigrant parents may go through when their children are on the path to succeeding and how that can breed resentment and jealousy. A lot of hard-hitting topics, so I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Lisa. We are here with Lisa Lee, author of American Han. She is the recipient of a Pushcart Prize and the Marianne Russo Emerging Writer Award from the Key West Literary Seminar. She holds an MFA from the University of Houston and a PhD in Creative Writing and Literature from the University of Southern California. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
Just looking at your bio, I didn't mention it earlier, but you have a bachelor's degree in English and also music theory. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that you have played an instrument in your career at one point. What instrument do you know how to play?
So the instrument that I stuck to for a long time and that I probably still know how to play now, though I have not tried in quite a long time, and I have carpal tunnel, so I don't even know if it would work out, but it's piano. I trained in classical piano and played competitively for a long time in childhood. I started at the age of 3 is when I picked it up, and surprisingly, you would think that my parents pushed me to do that. I begged for lessons. I wanted to do it so bad. Because my older brother played the piano and I really wanted to do it. And so my mom took me to a teacher and she said, well, I can't teach her until she knows how to read. So I learned how to read really quick, because I wanted to do it so badly. And so I learned how to read when I was 3 and then I started piano lessons at age 3, and did that for, I turned out to be very good when I was really small. And so, you know, then there was a lot of pushing because they were amazed at my abilities. And I did that probably until I was about 18.
Wow. Yeah, that is a long time. Marvin and I have both played instruments. We were both in band. I actually come from a family of musicians. My mom was a classical singer and pianist. So I did start piano at around the same age as you at 3, but I hated it. So I quit within a couple of years. So like, brava to you for hanging in there. And just to like add my 2 cents in, I played the oboe from middle school to high school. So that was my instrument, main instrument of of my musical career, which was thankfully just short. I didn't bring it to college with me. Marvin played the flute, right?
I was a flautist, and I played trombone, but it was I was not talented at all. It was just all my friends were doing it, and all my friends were in bands, so we just all, you know, ended up doing it through high school, and that was it. Yeah.
My family was just like, why do you have no musical talent when everybody else in the family has musical talent? But let's get into your writing journey. You majored in English. I'm guessing that reading was a big part of your life. You mentioned that you learned how to read at 3 years old. What did you grow up reading, and what drew you to storytelling?
Oh, that's a good question. I have no idea what I read when I was a kid. You know, sometimes I hear that I meet writers who give a talk on when they knew they wanted to be a writer, and they say something like age 7 or something. And I'm like, how could you know that you, what were you reading? What were you reading at age 7 that made you think, oh, you know, I want to do that? Was it Dr. Seuss? I don't know if they were just reading stuff way more advanced, but I actually don't remember much about the books that I was reading at that really young age. It was age appropriate books. It's not like I was reading way beyond what was expected of my age. But yeah, I did read a lot. My dad read all day when he was at home. All he did was read. And my mom took me to the library with my brother probably every week, because she loved that borrowing books was free. And we'd go and borrow like 30 books at a time, and we'd read all these books and bring them back the next week and get more. And I don't know, I just grew up really loving to read. And then, but I didn't think of those people who wrote them. I wasn't thinking of the authors who wrote those books. I sort of just read them as entertainment, I think, like I would consume television. And it wasn't until college that I really thought about those books as products, as art that was written by people, real people, and that it became known to me that that's something you could do. I think maybe a grad student told me, because I really liked the book Housekeeping by Marilyn Robinson. And I think it was a grad student who told me about how you could do an MFA. And did you know that Marilyn Robinson teaches at UC Davis? That's where she taught at the time. And you could go to UC Davis and do it wasn't an MFA at Davis, it was an MA, but it was, I think, basically the same thing. And you could work with her. And I just thought, well, why would I do that? It never occurred to me as something I could actually do. I knew that other people did it, but I didn't think of it as something that I could do. But I took some writing workshops in college, and I really liked it, but I didn't think seriously of it as something I could do. And when did I decide that was something I wanted to? Well, when I was in college, what I wanted to do, I thought it was a more responsible choice was to get a PhD in literature, because it was linked to reading and writing that I liked, and which was something I was drawn to. And I thought, well, if I like that, I should do a PhD in English, and then I can read and write as much as I want and write and think about the books that I like. But my parents did not go for that. It was a lot of shouting and, you know, you can't do that. And I thought it was responsible, but it wasn't responsible in their eyes, because, you know, they were like, well, who's going to pay for that? I think they didn't know at the time that a lot of these programs, you know, pay for. You don't have to pay for them, and you get paid a stipend. And so none of us knew that. And I ended up going to law school because that's what was pushed on me. And it was in law school that I realized I wanted to be a writer. I hated it so much, and I was so bad at it. I was just so bad at it, and I hated it so much that that's where I just had a meltdown. And I thought, well, I really don't want to do this. And if I'm going to defy, you know, everyone and go against what everyone's telling me I have to do, I might as well pick something that I really want to do. And that's when I knew I wanted to be a writer. And then I focused on that. I gave that my full focus. How do I do that? How do I make that happen? And so I remembered this talk about MFA programs, and I started researching them. and I just put all my effort into getting into one. And that's what I did.
Your journey really reminds me of your main character, Jane, in your book, because she also, goes to law school and is not enjoying the process. And yeah, it is very reminiscent of that. I can see that you put your personal experiences into the book. Speaking of the book, was that your first manuscript? Did you constantly work on that while you were in writing workshops, or did you have another manuscript in the drawer before you started querying for agents?
I was working on some version of that book since my MFA program, I think, but I wrote different stories with the same characters. I kept trying to write different books, and then I'd throw it out and start over and over. I did that a few times. And I mean, some of them are bizarre. I wrote a whole draft that was a Harold and Kumar picaresque, but instead of Harold and Kumar, it was Jane Kim and Margaret Cho's mother. And they're on a road trip, on a wild road trip driving to LA. And that just, I thought it would be so hilarious, and it wasn't. It wasn't funny at all. I wrote a few things where I was trying to write things that could never be associated with my life, that couldn't be seen as autobiographical, that nobody could imagine it really happened, because there's this curse that comes with being a female writer, and especially for writers of color, not just women writers of color, but all writers of color, that you're writing autobiography and that's all you can write. And so, I let that affect what I was writing, but it just, I finally, because nothing was working, I finally realized that I needed to just give myself permission to write about what I knew. And if people are going to think what they think, there's nothing I can do about it. So, I'm creating a fictional world. If people want to believe that's my life, that's fine. It already says that it's a novel and it's fiction.
I guess let's just get into your novel, American Han. For our listeners who aren't familiar with it yet, can you give us a brief description of what your book is all about?
It's about a Korean-American family living in the Bay Area of Northern California, taking place around the 1980s through the early 2000s. Growing up, the siblings, Jane Kim and her brother Kevin, they're really good at school, at tennis, at piano. Later, Jane goes to law school and Kevin tries to make it as a professional tennis player, but that doesn't work out and he becomes a police officer. Jane becomes disillusioned and stops going to class and considers dropping out. Meanwhile, their parents, who had spent decades running a string of small businesses, are having their own crises. And they separate, and the mom is trying to move to San Francisco, where Jane lives, to try to make it as a businesswoman. And she starts living in this basement office / storage space. And the dad decides to pursue his dream of becoming a long haul truck driver. And everybody's just so busy with their own problems and their own life changes that nobody notices that they haven't talked to Kevin and nobody knows how long. And then Kevin commits a crime, and it's a very public crime. And then they're all forced to reckon with his actions and to understand why it happened and what it means about them and about America.
Yeah, a lot of things happen. But I will say, even though a lot of things happen, it is quite a slow burn. It is more of a portrait than mm-hmm. Go, go, go type mm-hmm. of linear plot.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's interesting because we just had Lillian Lee on the podcast talk about her latest novel, Bad Asians. And that was a book all about specifically the way Chinese American parents can mess up their kids. Mm-hmm. And, while reading this book, I was thinking, man, this is very like, sometimes when we read books, like Rira and I will think about how the other person will feel. And as I was reading this book, like, man, I bet Rira's going through it right now. And then she posted on her Instagram that like she was definitely going through it while reading your book.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Because I am Korean, and I feel like Korean mother-daughter relationships, they're very intense. And
yes.
I do want to like get into that a little bit later, because I do want to kind of go over the definition of Han, because that is mm-hmm. a part of your book title. Mm-hmm. So I guess like for our listeners who are unfamiliar with the concept of Han, I guess like mm-hmm. the easiest way to describe it is this Korean concept of trauma and sorrow and rage that has just been passed on through the generations, because mm-hmm. Korea as a motherland had been oppressed by outside forces for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it does come from like classism and also like colonial influences.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious as to like, do you think there is a difference in Han in compared to like Korean motherland Han and Korean American Han?
Yes. And I'm hoping that I mean, there's no explanation of Han in my book. But what I have, so I did a PhD in creative writing, which included a critical dissertation, and on top of the creative dissertation, which was my novel. And my critical dissertation was on Han, but American Han. It was called Korean American Han. This was before I titled my novel American Han. But I went to Korea for a conference like 10 years ago, and that's how I learned that they don't believe in Han over there anymore. And they like it is since around the late 1990s. It's a thing that it sort of disappeared from the culture and from the Korean psyche. So I'm told that they're not concerned with Han anymore. They think that's a thing in the past, that it's irrelevant. And I read an article that a Korean scholar who's a professor in America, but of like European history, he wrote something about how Korean American writers are kind of obsessed with Han, and they try to use it to explain Korean culture to America. And he doesn't like that. Because he also says, like, they see Han as something old that's in the past. And I don't know. I don't claim to know what modern Koreans think about Han. I don't know what the modern Korean psyche is on that subject. But I do believe that there's such a thing as American Han. And I do believe that it's different from Korean Han. And what I think is that immigrants who immigrated after 1965, mostly in the late 60s and in the 70s and maybe even in the 80s, brought Han with them. They brought it with them. And they passed it down to their children. And it changed. It got blended in with American stuff, with American racism, with the pressure to assimilate, which includes the pressure to forget about the past. And it became this new form that's a new Han, and it's an American Han. And that's what I mean by that title. And yes, I do believe that American Han is different from Korean Han. And maybe it's true that it's not a thing in Korea anymore. I don't know. I'm not the one to say.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like sometimes that Han is kind of like a load-bearing theme in a lot of like mm-hmm. Korean-American literature, right? And I remember the first time I came into contact with that, where I'm Chinese-American, so I didn't grow up with Korean-Americans until I went to college. And it came up, I think it was after a night of drinking. It always comes up after a night of drinking, where someone was trying to explain why Koreans are so angry. And that's how I got like this big lecture on what Han is. And yeah. I think there's definitely like something to be said about like living with a chip on your shoulder, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just existing as a minority in America, right?
Yeah.
We all have like this chip on our shoulder. With mm-hmm. Koreans, it seems like there's this historic, like, if you're trying to find a reason why you feel this, like why you feel all these emotions, and then you can point to history and how history has like kind of screwed you and your family over for generations. I think I can see why people will latch on to that, especially as like Asian Americans living in this country where we're constantly at the same time trying to hold on to our culture, but also rediscover it.
I also think that like it's interesting that you mentioned like how Han is perceived in modern day Korea now, and it's very different from how Korean Americans perceive Han. And I think that's largely due to the fact that we're kind of in a time capsule here mm-hmm. in America. Mm-hmm. Like the Korea that our grandparents and our parents brought with them, it is like it is a time capsule of their time, and a lot of the patriarchy and misogyny also comes from mm-hmm. That era, and they brought it with them to America, and it is a trauma that gets passed down. Whereas I mm-hmm. feel like in modern day Korea, while you're living with people who look like you for the most part, mm-hmm. and you've kind of been living in a time where everything is being modernized, everything is about like racing towards the future. Mm-hmm. That concept of holding on to grudges and mm-hmm. sorrow, it does get eroded away. So I thought it was really interesting that you named your book American Han. And you said earlier that it wasn't your original title. Can I ask like what your original title was for this book? God.
I had so many. They were mostly placeholders. One of them was, the original one was Top Girl. But that was when it was a book that was mostly about Jane and less concerned with her brother and her dad. It was Jane, and there was a lot of her mom. So it was sort of more focused on a mother-daughter thing. I had a placeholder that was never going to make the light of day. I never told anyone about it, but it was Death and Poo. just because I couldn't figure out a title. So it said Death and Poo for like a year. And that's relevant because there's a scene in the book where the mom, Jane, is saying, anytime that I talk to my mom, I can be assured that her impending death is going to come up, and also the state of her bowel movements. Grief Party. I liked that one for a while, but then I was told it's too dark with the word grief, even though Han is worse than grief, I think. Grief was a problem, and then the grief party made it sound like a Tupperware party. I don't know. It was basically just, I couldn't come up with anything better or anything that fit the whole book, what I felt like the book represented. And so I ended up with American Han.
I think it's a great title. Yeah. I think you settled on a really good one. Yeah, so your book explores Korean patriarchy and mm-hmm. how that impacts everyone in Jane's family, and how the Korean patriarchy unfairly places impossible expectations on both men and women. And I just want you to kind of go over what those expectations are for our readers, for our listeners who are kind of unfamiliar with Korean patriarchy.
Okay, well, there's like a ladder, a hierarchy, kind of. So like the father is at the top, and nobody's allowed to be queer or gay or anything, right? It's everybody is straight, gender conforming. And so the father is in charge, and he has all the power and all the say. And, but he also has to, men have to earn that authority because they have to make a living and be able to support a family. And family is the most important above all else, is family. You have to have a family. And if you're a man, you have to support your family. And that's a lot of pressure, especially if you move to a new country and all the rules are different and you don't have access. It's hard to figure out how to make a living to support a family, especially somewhere where things are expensive. And then women, I don't know, women, it's just women have to fall in line and serve, I guess. The mother is supposed to cook and clean and serve the family. She's not expected to work. And then sons are the most important. Sons are the most important children, and the daughters are the least important.
And I would say daughters-in-law are the least important.
Oh, yes, daughters-in-law. Daughters-in-law, yeah. And I'm not talking about, obviously, I can't speak for all Korean families. I'm just talking about what I know in my own experience. I know that there are going to be a lot of Korean families who don't go by what I just described, and who are maybe more modern. And I'm talking about a version that they see as something in the past. I don't know, but it's something that I remember from my experience. But maybe not so true today. I don't know.
It is funny because, you know, boys were considered so important in like Korean family dynamics, because the boy is the one who's carrying the family line. They see daughters as some other family's child because they're going to marry out of the family. And it's very interesting because nowadays I'm hearing that daughters are more favored than sons in modern day Korea.
In Korea?
In Korea. They say like daughters, you know, they are emotionally intelligent. They're the ones who are taking care of their parents and also their in-laws. Like they are the ones who, like women are so educated now in Korea. So they're like, they go to like top universities and they're going to probably make money. But at the same time, this is oppressive because you are asking women to do all these things, all these tasks, to be a breadwinner, to be a caretaker, to be a mother. Mm-hmm. And also, like, they're saying, like, oh, we prefer girls because they meet our emotional needs. It's all about service rather than who they are as people. Yeah. So I thought that was very interesting, reading about that recently, and also hearing that from my Korean relatives, because they were telling me, like, oh, yeah, girls are, you know, very popular now in Korea. And I was like, it's very strange, but yeah.
I had no idea, but that sounds like a lot of pressure.
It is. And I feel like in traditional Korean patriarchal dynamics, like one gender is given all of the power, but they're expected to sacrifice a lot and to, you know, sacrifice for their family, to provide for their family. Their desires are always put in the back seat.
Right.
Whereas, like, with a lot of daughters, with a lot of women in the family, they are expected to inherit nothing. Like, don't expect anything from your family once they pass away. The inheritance is going to go to the sons.
Mm-hmm.
But they get some gifts in the meanwhile.
Right. Like, they get
Yeah, they get some, like, pretty things.
They get material items. They're maybe taken on more shopping trips. They get things, but the boys have to put their needs last. They're not allowed to have needs. But they do end up getting the authority and the power, and they inherit everything of value. It's very complicated.
It is very complicated. And I think your book does a really good job showing how, like, insidiously misogyny can be sown into young Korean boys. And, you know, Jane kind of sees the warning signs of Kevin becoming, you know, more hateful toward women in in like increasingly dangerous levels. And like, I feel like this is something that we are seeing now in America. Like, there is a lot of red pilling. There's the manosphere where there are a lot of podcasts who are telling boys and men that women are there to serve and that is all they're good for. And it just seems like it's an uphill battle. And, you know, Jane in the book, like, she can recognize how harmful this behavior is and how Kevin has really leaned into it, but can't really find a way to deter that path from him. So in your opinion, like, do you think there were steps Jane and her family could have taken to prevent Kevin's misogyny, or do you think it was inevitable?
I think that the way it seems like it's not inevitable after the fact, when you look back at things that could have been done different, when you realize things now that you didn't realize back then, you wish you could go back and change something, because you see the errors of the past, you see the mistakes, you see the missed opportunities. But I think that they were doing the best that they could do at the time and trying to survive. I think for them, what happened was maybe inevitable, but then as Jane looks back on it, she thinks of things that could have been done differently. Like, she could have connected with him more. She could have let him see that he wasn't the only one who was affected by the patriarchy and affected by American racism and white supremacy, so that he wouldn't feel like he was alone. But these are things that she's not capable of as a child and as a teenager, because you don't think about all that stuff when you're living in it. So I don't know. I don't know if this was inevitable or not. I think maybe for them it was, for these particular people.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why your title, American Hustle, is so apt and so evocative, right? Because it is like the accumulation of all these grudges, all these feelings, and everyone's going through, right? Your story takes place at a time after, like, the patriarchy has already done a number on this family, right? Has already done a number on Jane herself. And you find all three, like, all your characters in a time of crisis, right? Jane, you know, she wants to get out of here. She wants to quit law school and get out of town. Both of their parents are going through, like, midlife crises. And so I guess, can you talk to us about what your inspirations were of capturing, like, a family at this moment of time?
I think that, well, what inspired me to write the book, I think, was that, and to write this particular book after I'd written a few others that weren't working, with lots of similar characters, was I started thinking about that feeling of Han. I was thinking about Han. I wanted to understand that feeling, and I wanted to capture that feeling in the book. And I wanted to understand the anger in my own family. Like, we had a very angry household. I was very angry. I didn't even realize how angry I was. I was really angry. My family was very angry. And I wanted to understand why. Once I realized that it wasn't all that normal to be that angry, because you can't just go around. Society will shame you for expressing anger, especially me. Like, I wasn't allowed to express anger. I mean, certain people can express anger and it's seen as strong and masculine, but not for me. So once I'm shamed, then I realize that this isn't accepted. And so I wanted to understand it. Like, I had this need to understand the anger, and I wanted to understand the sources of my anger and the sources of their anger. And so that's really what I was trying to do when I wrote it. And I wanted to capture that feeling in the book.
Yeah, I mean, your book opens with essentially Jane's mom arriving unannounced, and immediately, even I felt like the, oh man, this is like a very, like the pressure is rising here.
Yeah, as a Korean daughter, I was very triggered by some of the things that Jane's mother said. And I guess this is a great time to talk about this. I feel like Jane's relationship with her mom is so reflective of so many Korean mother-daughter relationships out there, because my theory is that Korean mothers see their daughters as extensions of themselves. Mm-hmm. And the patriarchy has conditioned them to be hard on themselves. Mm-hmm. And no one is harder on yourself than your own voice. So because they see their daughters as kind of this mirror to their own, mirror to like their own flaws, that's why they're like so
mean,
harsh on their daughters, and they're so mean. And it is very complicated, because, you know, they're coming from, it's coming from a good place, like a place of good intentions, because they want their daughters to survive in this patriarchal world where women's value is not that high in in this hierarchy. So they're like conditioning their daughters by being mean, by telling them you need to lose weight, you need to be beautiful, like you need to go to a good school in order to get a good husband, to you know, be a good daughter-in-law, like you have to do these things. And they see it as like good parenting,
right?
Like it's like it's correcting bad behavior before it forms.
Right.
And yeah, I just want to hear your thoughts on like what are your thoughts on like Korean mother-daughter relationships, and how it's especially written in literature.
What I tried to do was try to look at that relationship with my best self. So look at her, that character, the mother, with as much understanding and empathy that I could. So it wouldn't be, I didn't want her to be depicted as a tiger mom or somebody with no feelings or no background or history that made her that way. I wanted to show why she might be harsh and be super mean and critical. And I wanted people to connect with her plight. I thought it was important to make her a real person who has her own background. And I wanted readers to have empathy for her too, and not just feel sorry for Jane, you know, oh, it must be terrible to have such a mean, bad mother. I wanted there to be understanding for the mother.
Yeah, I definitely got that feeling as well, because it's like the mom's first life as well as a mom. And, you know, so often like they, like mothers of that generation, they have to, you know, give up their ambitions, their dreams for the sake of supporting the family. And, you know, once that identity is kind of stripped away, like when your children don't really need you anymore, it's like you can't just pick up where you left off. Like you're not 25 anymore. You can't you can't go out and drink and like have fun. Like there are conditions that are not trapping you, but definitely restrict where you can go from there. So you can definitely see like this excitement for a new beginning with Jane's mom, but at the same time there's like this codependency that she has with her daughter.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I just became a dad for the first time at 40, and I still don't know what I'm doing, and I can't imagine being like in my early 20s and going through this, like, and you know, looking at like all the friends, all the people around me with kids and things like that, I feel like sometimes people just aren't ready sometimes for kids, like some, because your life does change and everything, like we said, everything's gets put on hold, and sometimes that resentment affects the way you treat your kids, right? And I think something that your book does, and a lot of like really great Asian American literature does, is allows us to like sympathize with the parents and what they must have to go through as new immigrants, as people also trying to figure out their lives, but also at the same time not forgive them for the actual harm they did to their kids, right?
Yeah.
And you know, that's a very fine line to to toe. And so can you talk a little bit about how you approach that line of, you know, making sure that we understand where the parents came from, but also showing what that manifested as for your, for Jane and her brother?
I wanted to understand, and I wanted a reader to understand where the parents are coming from, but some, the effects that happen, that their parenting and various choices they made for their children, and didn't let their children make their own choices, kind of thing, and the patriarchal way of parenting and the very gendered way of raising them, it had such a harmful and lasting effect for the children. And you don't really see it ending. You don't, you, it's not like you see them change that. So for Jane, she can understand. She can get to a point where she understands, but it doesn't mean that she's okay with it, right? So she can't accept it. She can understand it, but she can't accept it. So she's still going to have to go against them and go against their wishes and say, well, I hear what you just called me, but I'm just not going to listen to that, kind of thing. So yeah, sure, there isn't forgiveness, I don't think. There's just understanding. There's understanding, which is a type of forgiveness, but it's not a giving in, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's also less anger involved in the reaction when you understand, because you're not angry at just your parent who is your abuser. You're also angry at what made them become abusers, and you're angry that no one stood up for them when they were victims. And I feel like when you direct your anger at the correct source, it's not so explosive. And I think you did a really good job of just that balance of, like, how do you feel empathetic towards people who are physically abusive and emotionally manipulative to their children, but at the same time love their children and want them to enter this world that they can't walk through, because immigrant parents, they want their children to assimilate. They want them to succeed, become doctors and lawyers, because that is, those are positions of respect, and they'll be able to align themselves with power. But it's not a door that they can walk through, because it's considered a little too late for them. They are older. They don't know the language. They didn't grow up with the culture. And I feel like that does build up resentment. Do you agree with, like, this idea that immigrant parents can be jealous of their children, particularly their success?
Yes. Because they gave up everything. They sacrificed so much for their kids to have that success, to open all those doors and to have the access that they realize at one point they're never going to have. Maybe when they came here, they thought that they would have it, but then they learn that America's not going to let them have it. Yeah, I do think that there is definitely resentment about that, especially if you won't take the doors, if you won't walk through the doors that they opened for you, that they sacrificed for you, and you go in some other door where there's, like, no money and, you know, no stability and et cetera. Then they're like, what did we do all that for? Yeah, sure. And I was thinking about something else you said about redirecting anger. That's something that is really important in my thinking about this book, is all this anger needs to be redirected. Jane has a moment where she feels all this anger towards her mom, but then she feels it come back and go somewhere else. Like, she's still angry, but she's not as angry at her mom anymore. She's angry at what made her that way. So it's really important. I don't think there's anything wrong with anger. I don't think there's anything wrong with being very angry and being angry about a lot of things. It can be really helpful and useful as long as we direct it at the right place, at the right sources, at the right targets that are the causes of the problems. And it's just, we all need to learn to direct our anger, not at each other and at our people that we care about, but at the sources that are causing us to be hurt and disenfranchised and powerless.
Yeah, be mad at the patriarchy and capitalism. Yeah. Everything that is just, you know, making everything so hard for everyone. And it wasn't surprising to me that Kevin chose to be a police officer after he gave up his tennis career, because he has all this anger. And like, whether it was from seeing his father be physically abusive and have like bouts of explosive anger, like when he was cutting down his tennis rackets, for example, or, you know, hearing like very snide remarks about women from other, you know, father-like figures. Like, he had all this anger and it wasn't being directed at the right source. And when you keep it kind of bottled up, going into a profession where it allows you to have this legal protection of being violent is very appealing. So, like, did you know from the beginning that you were going to make Kevin a police officer?
He was always a police officer, even before he became very central to the book. It was really important for him to transition from maybe becoming a professional tennis player and going into policing, because that career was going to offer him everything that he felt he'd been denied. He wanted authority. He wanted masculinity. He'd been denied by America. He wanted power and control, and he was denied those things, by his father, by white supremacy, and by America. And he feels that becoming a policeman, where you're wearing a uniform and carrying a gun, and, you know, going around doing law and order, will get him the approval that he's craved all his life that he never got. It crosses over from the tennis, which is the only thing he felt that he was getting approval for. And then when he moves it into policing, it's just, he takes the violence part of it he takes it too seriously. It becomes part of his personality, I guess, when he moves it over there. I always knew that would be my character. I also have, it's not autobiographical, but I do in my real life have an older brother who's a retired police officer. And so I have certain knowledge from stories he's told me about his experiences of being a policeman in Northern California that I drew from for this character.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in addition to being a story about Jane and her mother-daughter issues, it's also a story about father, daughter, brother, sister. It's like, just, there's a lot going on in your book. And I really enjoy it. And, you know, we're coming up to the end of our conversation, but I did want to ask, you know, your book, and I can't believe I'm saying this, is also a period piece. You know, it takes place in 2002, which at this point is like 24 years ago, which
I know.
Oh my gosh.
You know, but it did remind me of, like, you know, it takes place in San Francisco. And at a time when, like, I still remember back in the early 2000s, I thought San Francisco was super cool. Like, I really wanted to live there.
Yeah.
Back in like the early 2000s. Like, these days, you know, it's been, you know, taken over by big tech, yeah, lots of things going on. But I remember, yeah, in that time and place, it was like where you wanted to go after college. Like, this is where you're,
yeah,
right. But yeah, I want to ask, like, there's a lot of reasons to set a story at a certain time period. Like, was this like a practical decision, or did you want to capture like this point in time for your book? Was this like a specific time you wanted to talk about for your story?
Well, I lived in San Francisco during that time period, and it was very life-changing for me, and it was a wonderful place to live. It was like the coolest place to live at the time. I had so much fun. I have so many good experiences of that time that I lived there. It's definitely not the same anymore. I recently went back, and it's like so much stuff is gone, and everything is shut down. I don't want to. People who live there are probably going to say, no, it's not as, I don't know. I was only there for a short period of time. And some of my old haunts are maybe, they're still there, but a lot of stuff has shut down, and like downtown is like, everything's closed. And I heard that they might be getting rid of the BART system soon, the subway, the BART. Because hardly anybody rides it anymore, which is crazy to me because it was packed all the time. Yeah. I just wanted to capture that time period when I lived there and sort of figured out who I was and who I wasn't. It was during that time. And I was a young person, and it was, you're going through changes and figuring out what you want to do. And you feel like you're too late because you're way past the age that you think you would have had it all figured out, but you're still in your 20s. People always think that they're too late or too old for whatever they're doing. But I just wanted to capture that time that I was there, coming of age, I guess.
Yeah, I think about how social media has changed so much on how we present ourselves in real life, and also uh-huh. just the consequences of our actions. And you do briefly mention that if Kevin had committed the crime that he committed in the book, like many years later, when social mm-hmm. media becomes a thing and every mm-hmm. camera is just online and your sins are just branded on the internet forever. Mm-hmm. Whereas mm-hmm. like, you know, it's the early 2000s. Social media doesn't become a thing until 2008 and mm-hmm. more popularized in the 2010s. So I think you did a really good job setting the story before that time period, because I think it would have been a very different book otherwise.
Yeah.
So we are at the end of our chat, and I would be remiss to not ask you, like, what are you working on next? Or are you, taking a break from this long project that took a number of years to get out?
Oh my goodness. I haven't started working on something new yet. I do have an idea in my mind that I don't want to say out loud in case I jinx it. Currently I'm still working on finishing up pieces related to my book coming out. So sort of wrapped up and caught up in all that. And once all the book talking and interviews and touring is over with, I'll probably get a chance to really think out this new book plan, which I think will be another novel.
Cool. Well, congratulations on the release of your novel. Looking forward to a lot more people being triggered by your words. but it is a really, I was gonna say fun. It was a fun read, but also very, like, very stressful, very tension filled, but also at the end, like, very, like, you know, it gives a very good glimpse into what American Han might be. And I think that in that way, the book was very successful. So thank you so much for your time chatting with us. And congratulations on the launch of your book.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Lisa Lee. Her novel American Haunt is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba online bookstore. So if you enjoyed our conversation and want to check out her book, you can pick up a copy by going to booksandboba.com and checking out our bookshop link. As always, all purchases made on our online bookstore support not only us at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstore as well. And yeah, before we call it an episode, just a quick reminder that our April 2026 book club pick is The Elsewhere Express by Samantha Soto Yambao. This was a patron's choice book club pick, so a big shout out to all of our Honey Boba members who chimed in to help us select this book for our book club. We are starting our read along on Discord this week, which again you'll have access to if you are a supporter of Books and Boba through our Patreon. We will be discussing up to the first third of the book starting this Friday, so I am very much looking forward to the discussion we will be having with our fellow book club members. It is a gorgeous looking book. Some of our book club members did pick up the limited first edition printing with the colored pages. The book is pitched as a Ghibli-esque fantasy about a train that picks up wayward souls to show them their purpose in life. So definitely looking forward to a very vibey read with all of you. And yeah, with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Lisa Lee for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @BooksandBoba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone. Especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa to current greats like Lia Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former Beer League player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.